potential, not pathology, embracing creative and resourceful approaches to psychotherapy with author and therapist, Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
Welcome to Potential Not Pathology, where we offer information and inspiration for mental health therapists who are interested in learning and applying unique therapeutic techniques and concepts into their work, with a focus on the potential each client brings to his or her therapy session. This program examines ideas and tools which can assist your clients on their journey toward healing. I'm Paul J. Leslie. I'm glad you're here. Today I get the joy of talking to a friend of mine, a gentleman by the name of Elliot Conney. Elliot is a really inspiring guy to me. He is one of the leading experts, in my opinion, in the field of solution-focused brief therapy. He's just setting some high standards, I think, for the field. And he's superb as a teacher as well as a therapist. So he and I chat today, and our focus was more on the aspects of finding strengths and resilience, not just in clients, but also in the therapists. He talked a good bit about getting away from the frame of a problem and how sometimes a therapist looking for solutions gets stuck in the problem and how we need to move away from that, as well as the expectancy of hope and authenticity on the part of the therapist is so important. Elliot is also the founder of the Conney Institute, and his website is elliotspeaks.com. And those resources, you're going to find a lot of wonderful videos, articles, information about how to utilize solution-focused brief therapy in ways that you might not have thought about previously. And I think anyone from any theoretical orientation will find value in these methods. So we had a lot of fun talking and interacting, and I hope you enjoy the interview with Elliot Conney. Elliot Conney, welcome to Potential Not Pathology.
Thank you.
I'm happy to have you here because I think you're going to be giving us some really good info today. I see you're a busy guy.
I do try, yes. I am a little bit busy.
Well, my friend, could you let folks who may not know you know kind of your background, what brought you to the field of psychotherapy and kind of your journey?
Sure, absolutely. So I don't know how detailed to get, so sometimes I get long-winded. My wife makes fun of me about that. But I grew up in Massachusetts, and, you know, I had a really, really – I mean, I had a good childhood. I enjoyed myself, and it was – I certainly remember lots of happy times and lots of fun. But there was a super big negative that was going on in my childhood, and that was my father was a very abusive, angry guy. And I grew up feeling like I wasn't very valuable to him or anybody else. And it was caused depression and anxiety, just, you know, sent me into a really, really rough spot. What saved me is I was good at athletics. So I would play sports, and I remember I wanted to get good at baseball, football, and basketball because those three sports happened at the three different times of the year, football being a fall sport, basketball being a winter sport, baseball being a spring sport, and I could play baseball through the summer. And my thinking was if I could have a sport every season, I don't have to go home, and thus I'm exposed to less abuse.
Right.
And also it helped me get grades because I had to be passing my classes in order to get good grades. So I always tell people I accidentally graduated from high school. I never one time thought what I wanted to be in the future. I remember my English teacher, we had this project. We were supposed to write down on a set of note cards, what did you want to be at 25? And I guess I misunderstood. I was probably a freshman at the time. I misunderstood what she meant. And I'm sure now she meant, you know, dentist or lawyer or doctor or psychotherapist or whatever. And I wrote on my note card, alive. Because that's how little about my future I was thinking about. And I went to college and did very well. The sport I played in college mostly was baseball. And I hurt my knee, and I hurt my knee real bad to the point where it was going to alter my ability to play. I wasn't as good anymore. And, you know, the type of injury that now, with about the surgery about 10 months off, they can bring you back pretty good. But that wasn't the case for me. And for the first time, I felt really, really lost. And that childhood depressive thing had come back. And I'm now in Texas, and I just don't know what the heck I'm going to do with my life. And I had somebody said something to me once. I was majoring in psychology, and I can't even tell you why I picked that major, even though it ended up being one of the most important decisions I ever made. But I was majoring in psychology, and somebody asked me what I was going to do after I graduated, and I really didn't know. Now, I'm old enough that I kind of predate like social media and even like the vastness that the internet is now. And right. I don't know if you guys remember, or if you remember the website monster.com. Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. So I went on monster.com to see what I could do with a degree in psychology, like what kind of jobs were available. And I saw, you know, you could be a caseworker and a case manager and an intervention specialist, like all these titles for all these jobs at agencies. And they all said you should have 2 years of experience. So I thought, well, I'll just start getting my experience now and see if I can find a job in the field. I started working at a halfway house for people getting out of prison and people doing extended stay drug treatment. And I absolutely loved it. Like having the ability to watch people reacclimate to society and watch people get clean and healthy. It just floored me of the strength of human resilience. Like some of these people, like I thought my life was troubled. I mean, some of these people had a background that I literally have no idea how they got up in the morning. But not only were these people getting up in the morning, they got up in the morning with hope. And they got up in the morning with vibrance. And they got up in the morning with a desire to be better. And it completely touched me. Like I know it might sound hokey and crazy, but it completely touched me.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to become a psychotherapist. And when I was pursuing the degree in psychotherapy, I was actually really disappointed because psychotherapy didn't seem to be hopeful. Like I was being taught to diagnose. I was being taught to assess. I was being taught about the fragmented part of the human experience. But in my job, I was witnessing what I genuinely, honestly considered miracles. Mm-hmm. And I decided I was going to quit. Like, there's no reason to become a psychotherapist if I don't want to do that job. And then I was introduced to solution-focused brief therapy just in a class. And it was the first time that I read any text that it was describing the human being that I wanted to be as a professional. And I needed to learn more about this stuff. So I started studying it, I started watching it, and I just became hooked because it seemed to be in line with what my thinking was about the way that humans would grow and the way that the capacity of human beings, regardless of their background. It made me think of my own childhood differently. Like instead of being regretful that I had this horrible experience with my father, I began to question myself, like, how did I escape that with an intact psyche enough that I could graduate from high school and I could go to college and I could go to graduate school? And it impressed something upon me that I still haven't been able to let go.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes, you know, our wounds are our greatest teachers. And certainly for a lot of us, it gives us a direction to help others. Your comment about resilience, I don't think enough attention is being paid to that term in our field, unfortunately. And could you talk a little bit about why you believe focusing more on resilience will probably lead to better treatment outcomes?
Sure. Well, first I'll say I agree with you. I can go into any graduate program and I can ask, you know, can you tell me some information about depression? And they'll be like, yeah, we have all kind of books about it. We have articles about it. We have a professor here who specializes in that and dot, dot, dot. If you say, can you tell me about resilience? We don't have the equivalent amount of information, but that's actually what we need to know to help people change. To use an analogy, if I have to accomplish a task, I'm better off thinking about the tools I have within me to get the task accomplished And I'm less effective if I think about the impactfulness of the task. Like, for example, if I'm going to climb Mount Everest, that's a huge task. If I think, and look, I am a amateur climber, novice climber at best. But let's say I hire the world's greatest climber and climb instructor to train me for a year. And he's going to, in a buddy system, we're going to climb Mount Everest together. Would I be better served to study Mount Everest? Or would I be better served to study our acumen as climbers? The training we put in, the hours of preparation we did, the experience of this expert, so on and so on and so on. The more we focus on our own capabilities, the more capable we become.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. And you know what's interesting to me is specifically the field of solution-focused therapy, which you're a proud practitioner of. It's always seems to be, let's look for the exception to the pathology or the pain or the hardship.
Right.
And why is it so important to you personally when you're working with clients and people in all walks of life, whether it's coaching or therapy, to really focus on those exceptions?
Well, so I'll say something. Our work in the solution-focused world has evolved a bit. Like, exceptions are very, very important, but I'm mm-hmm. going to add a little, you know, extension upon this. I wouldn't yes. say that we look for exceptions to the problem, because in our opinion, that still acknowledges the problem.
Yes, yes.
So if someone comes in and says, excuse me, I have depression, I wouldn't say, tell me when you didn't have depression, because it still acknowledges your current status, your current symptomology of depression. I think right. What we're inclined to say these days is we treat people as the exception. So instead yes. of saying, you know, when didn't you have depression, I would say things to them like, when were you able to overcome the symptoms of depression and be the person you've always wanted to be, if only for a minute? Mm-hmm. And then when they tell me, like, oh, you know, like last week, I actually felt really good when I was at my son's basketball game watching him play basketball. I'm going to ask, what do you have with inside of you that allowed that moment to happen? Because what we tend to do is we treat the exception circumstantially.
Yeah.
The exception as if it's not anything within me. It's just because I like watching my son play basketball. Or mm-hmm. I like, you know, drinking eggnog with all my friends during the Christmas season. Or whatever the positive thing is. But mm-hmm. the simple truth is, if the positive thing happened and you didn't have the capability within you, it wouldn't have produced the outcome. So we want to highlight the exception was because of you. Now, sure, a circumstance might have turned it on, but if it wasn't inside of you, it wouldn't have been able to turn it on. So it's super important that we help people identify that, yes, you might have ADHD or depression or whatever, but you also hold within you the ability to overcome it that you sometimes actually use, and sometimes you use it without your knowledge. We want to know how you did that.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that. Unfortunately, I think too many therapists and who are trying to work from a solution perspective forget, like you say, that in order to have a solution, you have to have a problem. And the solution is in, it sounds like from your perspective, is taking in more of the holistic view of the individual's resources rather than, okay, let me figure out a solution to the problem.
Right.
Because it locks you in that frame of the problem.
That's right. That's right. And we are trying to sidestep the frame of the problem altogether. The problem, you know, people say, like, you know, a solution-focused therapist doesn't believe in problem. Of course I believe in problem. Like, people have problems.
Yeah.
I just don't think the problem is relevant to the work I'm doing as a psychotherapist, because there's this other thing we're doing. And to give you an example, I saw an individual, this is several years ago, and this guy drank so much. He was a very successful businessman. He sold his business for many millions of dollars in his 30s. So now he's coming to see me. He's about 50. And all he does every day is he wakes up and he drives to a bar where he has lunch and drinks what he said was about 20 to 40 whiskey shots.
Wow.
Then he stays there playing darts, just hanging out at the bar because that's what he did. And then he goes to another bar, and he drives himself to another bar where he hangs out the rest of the night. And he's very much like a local celebrity. I mean, everybody knows this guy. He sold his business and all that sort of stuff. He's got oodles and boodles of money, and he's always, you know, buying drinks for so-and-so and this and that and all that sort of stuff. And the reason he had to come to therapy was he got his third DUI.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes to therapy saying, I got these three DUIs, and here are the consequences that I might be facing and all that sort of stuff. And I asked him, are there any times that he's able to disobey the problem drinking in him? And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he, well, most days you obey it. You wake up and you go do the problem drinking. Are there any days you disobey it? And he laughed and he said, yeah, on days I have to go pick up my dry cleaning, I don't really drink. And I thought, well, that's a weird thing. Why not? Like, what is it about the days you go when you have to go pick up your dry cleaning? He said, my dry cleaner is on the other side of town away from the bar I go to at lunch. So on those days, I never go to that lunch bar. I just go get my dry cleaning. And I said, what difference does it make for you? You know, typical solution-focused questions. What difference does it make for you on those days not to be doing the drinking? And he said, I know sometimes I feel kind of proud of myself, and I always feel a little bit better. And this guy had a health issue. I don't know if you've ever seen people drink to that degree. You can almost, like, see their liver popping out. It looks like they have a pot belly, but it's actually the solidifying of their liver as a consequence of all that drinking.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about how he felt better, and he slept better, and he rested better, and his wife was more appreciative, and all that sort of stuff. But he, through the questioning, he began to give himself credit for the not drinking. It wasn't just a consequence of him driving away. It's actually a consequence, driving in a different direction. It's actually a consequence of him making different decisions. And when he connected it to a positive outcome, he got better. He got better. And one of my favorite things I've ever got, like sometimes my clients send me, you know, little notes in the mail, Christmas cards and that sort of thing. Without question, the most touching thing I've ever received was that man's 1 year sobriety chip. I have it on my desk in my office sitting there. But he mailed me a letter with his 1 year sober chip.
Wow. Oh, that's so cool. And you know, for a lot of people, it sounds so simple. But sometimes the simple is usually the best.
Well, and also I would say the simple, it is simple. But I think the complexity of solution-focused brief therapy relies in its simplicity. Because we think we should be doing more. But the simple truth is, as a psychotherapist, the more I do, the less the client is doing.
Yes.
I want to do, I don't want to say less because it sounds like I'm not working, but I'm working very, very hard to stay simple and just elicit a detailed description of the client's preferred future. In this particular case, his preferred future was to not get DUIs, and that meant doing something about his drinking and his personal health. And my job is just to do a detailed description. And whatever the client does, right? Like it's not up to me. I can't make the client do something they don't want to do. But somehow in our brains as a clinician, I think it's a consequence of our training. It's a consequence of our education. We think we have to develop some sort of complex, interesting, amazing intervention. And the simple truth is, the more complex and amazing we get, the less likely the client is to become amazing. And I want them to be amazing.
I love that. I love that so much because I found that true because the more complex we get, particularly when we enter the realm of what I refer to as interpretation therapies, it gets more and more complex because you could have certainly gone down the rabbit hole to a lot of past history, existential angst, all those kind of things. And sometimes, you know, maybe that's required, but by focusing on, like you say, you know, bringing out the rock star within them,
right,
rather than, you know, look how smart I am as a therapist. I detected that his great grandmother had a drinking problem, and that's due to the id that is out of control with the ego, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's just utilizing what they already have.
That's right. That's right. And it's, you know what, I was watching a movie recently, the remake of The Karate Kid with Jaden Smith, Will Smith's kid, and Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in the movie where Jaden Smith and Jackie Chan walk up what seems like an endless amount of stairs to get to this fountain. And Jaden Smith is looking in the fountain, and of course Jackie Chan is being the you know, Mr. Miyagi teaching character. And he says to Jaden Smith, being still and doing nothing are not the same thing. And I think that a lot about my work in solution-focused brief therapy. Being simple and doing nothing are not the same thing. You have to work very, very hard to be simple.
Yes.
You have to trust the process, and you have to trust the client's capabilities in order to be simple. And to be very honest, that's hard because we are not taught in graduate school, or at least I'm not aware of a graduate school, that teaches to trust your client. And I don't mean trust what they're saying, like if they say they only drank 5 beers, believe them. I mean trust that they have within them, within themselves, the capacity to change. And we're certainly not taught to trust the process. In fact, we're taught the opposite. If you're doing an approach and it doesn't seem to be working, find the approach that matches the client problem and then do that. Which I find silly because there's literally no research at all to support matching the problem in therapy and treatment modality leads to better outcomes. But yet that's exactly how we teach it. And in order to stay congruent and simple, and as you said, to allow the rock star and the client to come out, we have to be simplified in our approach and we have to stick to it. Because the moment you abandon what you're doing, you're communicating to the client, I don't really believe in you. And that's harmful. That's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, since I've got you for a little time, I'm going to ask you a more of a specific question than I usually ask my guests, because I know you, like myself, you do a lot of work with couples.
Yes.
And I would like to kind of get your take on the challenges of working with couples, but also the amazing things that can happen, and kind of what's your perspective on working in that niche?
So me working with couples was an odd thing. So I had a job in an agency, and I was working with adolescents, and I loved it. You know, I talked about that agency time, and I absolutely loved what I was doing. And like, the politics of agency work was a whole nother story, but I loved the actual clinical work I was doing. When I decided to go into private practice, you know, I did all the stuff you're supposed to do. Like, I got business cards and I set up a website and all that stuff. And then to my surprise, a bunch of couples kept coming into my office. And I say I was surprised because I wasn't doing any marketing. Like, you know what I mean? I didn't market myself as a couples therapist. And I really didn't want to work with couples. They absolutely scared the daylights out of me. And I'm sure you've been there. And people listening to this, like, sometimes you feel like you're just refereeing a fight
with
two people who absolutely loathe one another. And, it was scary, and I didn't want to do it. So I had a really tough decision to make. Like, I was doing solution-focused therapy at the time. So do I stick to doing solution-focused therapy with couples, or do I find another couples approach that would be as congruent that I could do? So I did what any studious person would do. I started shuffling through books and research articles and that sort of thing. And I was shocked to find very little resources. Like, obviously, the work of Michelle Wiener-Davis was available. But her books are written as self-help, I mean, and they're good books, but they're written as self-help tutorials to the actual couple. I didn't find any, like, treatment guide to the clinician. So here's an example of what I needed to figure out. In solution-focused brief therapy, most people are aware of what we call the miracle question. So I had to ask myself, do I ask the miracle question twice, or do I ask it once and tie it together? So, for example, if I'm talking to a couple, do I say to the partner A, so suppose you woke up tomorrow and a miracle happened, what's the first thing you'd notice? And then do I say the exact same thing to partner B, in essence asking two different questions? And I decided I couldn't find that answer in any book or any research article. So I decided I'm just going to experiment and see what I could come up with. So I would ask couples that question, and I realized I can't ask it that way, because if I do, the couple is more likely to argue. You know, the brilliance of solution-focused brief therapy is actually in the subtleties of the approach. So if I say, so husband, suppose you woke up tomorrow and a miracle happened, what's the first thing you notice? The husband is likely to say, my wife would not be doing the things she does to annoy me.
Right.
And then if I said to the wife, she'd say, well, my husband is not, would not be doing the things he does to annoy me. And I realized that was difficult because, number one, it's kind of an insult to their partner. Number two, your miracle can't be someone else changing. So I had to come up with a way to tie their two miracles together, which in essence makes more sense because they live in the same world, in the same home, in the same construct. So I had to say, what's your conjoint miracle? So suppose the two of you woke up tomorrow and your conjoint miracle was happening. What's the first thing you'd notice? And I had to figure out a way to ask that question. And that really was the beginning of my love, my joy for doing solution-focused therapy with couples. And then obviously led to me writing a book about that, Solution Building in Couples Therapy.
Yeah. You know, as you were telling that about them, the couples just kind of showing up, you probably have noticed this as well, that, and I don't want to get too esoteric, but it seems like sometimes the things that we need to work on just keep showing up in our office.
Yes.
And whether that's our own personal stuff or some area that of our practice that maybe we haven't considered before, they just kind of show up. I remember I've always worked with couples. I really work with anybody, families, individuals. But when I was going through divorce, it seems like I'd look on my schedule and going like, where are all these couples coming from?
You're right.
You know, it's like the universe said, okay, it's time for you to face your stuff. But at the same time, it was it's kind of cool because I got to see a lot of the similar dynamics that were happening in my own relationship. And it was a good growth process for me. So with that said, when you're working, not just with couples, but individuals, families, how do you kind of monitor that that personal growth of yourself as a therapist? Do you I guess what I'm asking is, do you notice that the more you work with different groups, the more you learn about yourself and about your own resources?
You know, it's so funny you ask that because I'm writing a book right now with a friend of mine, Dr. Adam Froer, and we're working on a chapter called vicarious resilience. Now, in the field, there's a lot of study on what we call secondary trauma.
Right.
So, you know, if you hear enough client trauma stories, in essence, that trauma splashes upon you and you go home with some of the symptoms.
Right.
I think that is also true about vicarious resilience. I think my client's resilience splashes upon me. And one of the things that just is the type of person I am, and I really do think this is because of my childhood, I am continuously amazed by the capabilities of human beings in difficult times. So watching people pull their marriages like from the brink of divorce, I literally keep all of those notes in my head, or when clients are kind enough to send me a note in the mail or Christmas cards, I keep them forever because I always want to remember how capable people are. Like one time I saw a couple, and you know, in solution-focused brief therapy, our first question is, what are your best hopes from our talking? And I sat down with this couple and I said, what are your best hopes from our talking? Never met these people before in my life. And the husband said, well, I don't really know why we're here. We just signed our divorce papers this morning.
Wow.
And I was like, what? And they said, yeah, we agreed to go to therapy like a month ago, never got around to it. So at the courthouse, or never got around to it. So last week we scheduled an appointment. After we scheduled the appointment, the attorneys called us and said, we've set you up to go to the courthouse and sign your divorce papers to make your divorce final. So they had already scheduled an appointment. Then the attorney sets up the meeting to finalize their divorce. And then the therapy appointment happens. So they go to the courthouse, they sign their papers, and they said, should we cancel the appointment? And they said, no, well, let's keep it. We've never done this before, so let's see what would happen. So I'm talking to a couple that finalized their divorce hours prior. That couple is still married today. They remarried, and every Christmas time, I get a card from them. That stuff completely impacts me. I'm just amazed at people. So no, what happens is, number one, I don't view problems in my own life the same because I've seen a countless number of examples of people overcoming something that they themselves didn't think they could overcome. But also, when I'm working with clients, if you come into my office and you tell me you have the mother of all problems, because I've been witness to so many examples of resilience, I've now lost my ability to determine if, whether or not you are the next miracle. So I just assume, even if you have the mother of all problems, I just assume you can do it.
And that's such an important assumption, because you're already setting the frame for change with that mental assumption.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ingredients we know, I mean, Scott Miller talks a lot about this. I mean, there's several that talk a lot about this, but one of the ingredients we know that factors in heavily to the outcome of therapy is the therapist's hope and expectancy for change. If I lose my ability to be hopeful and expect you to change, you're significantly less likely to change. And that's not groundbreaking. We know that. I mean, think about like people with children, right? If you said to your child, I'd like you to do your math homework, but I don't think you're going to do it. I've just set you up to not do it.
Right.
My mother, who I still believe as a child, like, you know, as I just said, I had a very difficult experience with my father. And my mother, I think, was the greatest, you know, therapist in the world. Yeah. But what my mother would do is she needed me and my brothers to pull our weight around the house because she couldn't really depend on my dad. And right. My mom would say things like, Elliot, I need you to do the dishes and clean the bathroom. Like, two of the worst chores in the house. I hated those two chores more than I can capably describe now in adulthood. And my mother would say, she'd pull me aside away from my two brothers, and she'd say, you know why I asked you to take care of the kitchen and the bathroom? I'm like, no, Mom, how come? And she's like, because you're the one I can trust to do that big task. And I really need it done in a proper way. And you're the one I can depend on to do that task. And I remember welling up with pride that my mom trusted me to do it. And I never questioned her again, because she had hope and expectancy and belief in me. If my mom had said, you're a knucklehead and I don't think you'll be able to do it, I'm only asking you because I know I'm going to get to punish you later if you don't, I wouldn't have been as prideful and as dutiful in essence, taking care of her. That's how it felt to me as a 10-year-old boy. And I think the same thing is true with our clients. I have to expect they have the capacity to change, because any other thought for me makes my job as a clinician harder. And I don't know why I would do that. I wouldn't want to do anything or have any thought in my head that would make my job as a clinician any more difficult.
Right. And boy, don't we have our heads full of all kinds of preconceived ideas, even, you know, you and I have been at this a little while, but I don't know about you, but I still catch myself every now and then going, ah, Paul, hold on. That's your stuff, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, as Steve DeShazer used to say, whenever you get a theory in your head, just shake your head until it falls out. Because every now and then you know, you can't help it. You just have a thought. And I have to remember it's my job to ask questions that elicit a detailed description of the client or couple's preferred future. And I've got to stick to my job, regardless what's going on in my head. I got to stick to my job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why like people who follow me, they're always like, man, you release a lot of videos and a lot of videos for free of actual sessions, because I think you have to see it happening in order to believe it can happen. So I want to show everybody, like, yes, this stuff happens when all you do is the simplified step of asking clients questions that are related to their preferred future, because it produces meaningful change. And if you follow me, I'm going to show it to you. I'm going to prove that that's an actual, that's a truism.
Right. Yeah. Well, one thing, many of your videos, which I recommend everyone check out, it kind of reminds me too, not just of the questions you're asking, but of your presence. I can remember when I was in grad school, I bought some Virginia Satir videos because I wanted to know about more of her approach.
Right.
And to be quite blunt, the most important thing I got out of the videos was not her techniques or her questions, but was her presence. And when she was engaged with her clients, she was 150% engaged. And I see that in you as well. Could you just briefly kind of talk about that engagement?
No. Well, first of all, thank you. And yes, I think the presence of the clinician is more important than the technique. And in fact, I think the technique, oh boy, how do I say this? I think without proper presence, the technique quickly becomes irrelevant. Because if I say, so it's you again, what are your best hopes now? you're gonna quickly pick up, like, this therapist is not super into what he's doing, and in essence isn't super into helping me and my life. Teachers are that way. I'm sure anybody listening to this, you can think back on teachers you had, and the teachers you really like are the teachers who, for whatever reason, seemed like they were born to be a teacher. Like, they were built to be helping you learn. And the teachers you didn't like were the ones who, as soon as the bell rang at the end of school, couldn't wait to get out of there. And we know that those engaged teachers produce more learned students. Well, the same thing is true in psychotherapy. I don't know how to not be enthusiastic about someone who hit a rough patch in their life. They have endless choices, and they chose me. Like, I have no idea how to not be passionate about that. And now they're sitting in front of me, and they're telling me their story. I have no idea how to not believe in that person, man. Like, I could almost get teary-eyed now. I have no clue how to listen to someone's story and not think, just the act of coming to therapy, the bravery of recounting that story to a complete stranger, is a statement of your own hopefulness over the problem, even if you don't describe it as such. So my presence represents my own enthusiasm for the person's capacity to change. And I have no idea how to not be enthusiastic about that. I don't want to not be enthusiastic about that. And I absolutely believe that that is far more important than any technique or question I would use in session. Now, when you match your enthusiasm and your stance to a type of therapy that matches you and your personhood, that's when I think you can produce consistent outcomes in your client's life.
I agree with that 100%. I've got a wonderful colleague who is so authentic in her therapy sessions that sometimes I actually can hear the sounds of her yelling at her clients through the door. And but it's always, I know if she's gotten to that point, it's there to shake them up in a good way. And they'll leave all shook up, sometimes, you know, pissed off, and then they'll be back next week, and you'll see the changes. And I guess, you know, for some people that wouldn't work because that's not who they are. That's
exactly right.
But just having that, as you say, that presence, being authentic with good technique, and maybe knowing when to yell or not yell, it might take us a lot further. Why do you think so many therapists are, I guess I shouldn't generalize here, but why do you think some therapists are hesitant to, they think they're being authentic, but they're really kind of hiding behind the technique? Why do you think they're hesitant to just, you know, be themselves?
Because we don't teach that to them. We teach, when you watch a video, what people are typically watching is for the, people typically watch for two things, actually. The outcome in the client, because I show a lot of video. I show them in my workshops. Like, I show them kind of everywhere. And people will very frequently say, wow, look at the change in the client. And I would say, like, don't watch the change in the client. Just trust that's going to be there. Watch the congruence in the clinician that produced the change in the client.
Yes.
The second thing we watch typically is we watch for the techniques used. We watch for the interventions used. So we watch for the outcome in the client, or we watch for the techniques used, almost ignoring the congruence of the therapist who is doing the therapy, because that's what actually produces outcomes. We know that. So I think it's so important that we change the way we teach, and we have to teach people kind of what you said about Virginia Satir. Yes, her techniques are important, and you should learn them. Yes, the client is fascinating. You should watch them. But watch how Virginia Satir was doing something that seems to fit with who she is. That's an important component. Right. We don't teach it.
Yeah, it's. I remember you always read it, though, you know, in the books, and your instructors will say, you know, you have to be authentic, and it's kind of, I think, due to Carl Rogers, it's, you know, one of those kind of thrown around terms, you know, you got to be authentic. But it just seems to me that the more authentic you get, the more uptight the graduate school instructors got that you were being authentic. And, you know, you got to follow the plan, whatever the plan is, according to them. And I think maybe sometimes we have post-graduate school PTSD when it comes to, you know, interacting with clients and just being who we are. And so as we're rapidly coming to the end of the interview, we could probably talk for hours, but I got two questions left. The first question I want to ask, what if you had to give some advice to a new student coming out of graduate school who, you know, these ideas that we're discussing is intriguing to them, they're interested, but they don't know where to start. What do you think the most important thing, just one thing that they should focus on to make them a good therapist?
I'll say two things if I can. Number one, yeah. I would say fall in love with people. Whatever it was that drove you into becoming a psychotherapist, because I mean, to me, it's almost like a spiritual calling. It's like becoming a teacher. It's like becoming a minister. I mean, most of us don't grow up, unless you had parents that were psychotherapists, you don't grow up saying like, ooh, I'm going to be a psychotherapist. So whatever happened in your life to cause you to want to reach down and help people, never lose sight of that. Always stay in love with people. The second thing I would say is when you go to graduate school, as you know, you're going to be introduced to literally hundreds of psychotherapeutic approaches. Number one, be brave in your application of trying them, because the only way you can know if a shoe fits is to put it on.
Right.
Number two, look for an approach that sounds the way you talk. And it fits with the way you think about the world, the way you think about change. And I think a lot of times students confuse what they like and what they can do. So, for example, I like CBT. I like psychoanalysis. I have a somebody in one of my courses right now who's been trained to do psychodrama. I like psychodrama. But
yeah,
it's a different question. What do you like versus what can I do for the next 60 years? And what I can do for the next 60 years is be the best Elliot I can be. And that means I have to have an approach that sounds the way I already naturally talk and I already naturally think about the way that change occurs. And I would say, number one, don't confuse what you like and what you can do. And when you're sitting in the classes and your professors are introducing you to all of these videos and all of these approaches and all of this research, you're going to be like, ooh, I really like this one and I really like this one. But the question isn't, what do you like? The question is, what speaks to me?
Right. That's excellent advice. All right, so my last question is really more just a request for info. You've got a whole bunch of cool stuff going on, bro. I know you got this solution-focused university now going. I'd like for you to just take the next couple minutes. Let people know how they can find out about you, how they can train with you, how they can get your videos. Just go for it.
Absolutely. So if you want to follow me, go to ElliotSpeaks.com, and you have to spell Elliot right, two L's, two T's, ElliotSpeaks.com, and you'll find everything I do there. That is the best website to find all of my resources. And here, actually, as people are listening to this, it'll probably be going on, but once a year, the underpinning of solution-focused brief therapy is our ability to ask useful questions. And the thing I love doing every year is I do a free training series on how to ask questions and never get stuck in session. Like what students always say is, oh, I tried solution-focused brief therapy and I got stuck. And, you know, as you and I have been at this for a while, but, you know, sometimes you dread that feeling of getting stuck because you feel incompetent. So once a year I do a free training series on how to know how to ask the next question in every session, in every situation, so you don't get stuck. So you're building questions that lead towards a meaningful change in the client's life. And you can find that out at thequestionsmethod.com or thequestionmethod.com, actually. So if you go there, that training series will be available. And if it's not, just if you watch this too or listen to this too late, just sign up and be on my notification list. And then the third thing, as you mentioned, I just released a program called the Solution Focused University, and it's super great. So every month we have a guest lecturer that talks about solution focused brief therapy, how they apply it in their work, and loads of research resources that are uploaded once a month to the members. And I'm just thrilled about it. And to find that, go to solutionfocusedbrieftherapy.com. And just join the notification list. We only open registration a couple times a year. It would make my life way too hectic if we were constantly taking on new members to that, but we only do it a couple times a year. So if you go to that website, you can check out the membership stuff. and then join the notification list, and I'll let you know as soon as we open registration. So there you go.
Okay, awesome. Well, listen, my friend, keep doing what you're doing. You're doing some great work. You're putting fantastic resources out there for therapists, and I think you are somebody that we all need to keep our eye on, because I think you are transforming the field, and we need that, and I appreciate that.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. This was fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So next time, you want me to bring you a Red Sox jersey to next time?
Now you know. You know, if you bring your Red Sox jersey, I'm probably going to do something vile to it. So no. You want to waste right. your money or buy me a car rag? Yes, bring me a Red Sox jersey.
All right. Elliot Conney, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thank you for listening to Potential Not Pathology with Dr. Paula J. Leslie. If you enjoyed the show, check out our website at potentialnotpathology.com, where you will find programs and articles showcasing unique and creative therapeutic applications.